injuries, two of them severe. They are being evacuated to Tromso, to the hospital there at present.
Nearly £40 billion has been wiped off the value of Britain's biggest companies. The FTSE 100 plummeted again today, closing at 52.46, a fall of 2.7%. Over the week, it's down almost 10%. It's because of concerns over the debt crisis in the Eurozone and worries over growth in America. It's reported one of the three people jailed over the death of baby Peter has been released from prison. Jason Owen was serving 6 years for causing or allowing the death of 17-month-old Peter Connolly. The 39-year-old's been released halfway through his jail term. The man who threw a foam pie at Rupert Murdoch has had his sentence reduced. Jonathan May Bowles pleaded guilty to assaulting the 80-year-old as he gave evidence to a Commons committee. The comedian's 6-week prison sentence has now been cut to 4. Rowan Atkinson has left hospital after being injured when he crashed his McLaren F1 car in Cambridgeshire. It's thought to be the second accident he's had in the supercar. Our reporter Darren Little, who's outside the hospital in Peterborough, says he was lucky to only have minor injuries.
The McLaren F1 car that he was driving spun several times. It hit a signpost and then a tree, and then it caught fire.
And in sport, Arsenal have a tough task to reach the group stage of the Champions League. They've been drawn against the Italians Udinese in the playoffs. The first leg will be at the Emirates on August the 16th. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Bristol's favourite soul institution, the Soul Train, is back on air this Sunday on BCFM 93.2. Check us out and tune in 7pm to 9pm for the finest in soul and jazz funk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review the news this week is Conservative Councillor for Froome Vale, Leslie Alexander, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the NHS is not for sale, say the slogans, but is it being privatised anyway? Laura Treasure and Sarah Pinch at the University of Bristol's Hospitals Trust haven't returned my phone calls inviting Bristol NHS on to explain these changes tonight, but we are joined by a patient advocate and also by a retired doctor to check up on how patients are being affected by Andrew Lansley's changes. And it's uncovered criminal lodges at the heart of the criminal justice system and exposed corruption in Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist squad and in Downing Street. Yet all these crimes are so far unpunished and most of the crooks may be still in their taxpayer-funded jobs. Anyway, the public inquiry into the scandal is being run by a judge who parties with and accepts favours from the heir to the Murdoch empire. So we hear what investigative journalist Michael Gillard thinks is at the heart of the phone hacking problem. And as the 10th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks in the US comes nearer, what really happened that day? Did the media spike some stories that didn't fit in with their preferred versions of events? We hear from a senior US Marine Corps veteran and former head of the US Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, about who he thinks carried out the 9/11 attacks and, more importantly, why. That's in the second hour after six. Well, on to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and some light rain this weekend. Highs of 20 Celsius, fairly sunny on Saturday, but showers on Sunday. Next week, highs 20 Celsius, a fair amount of sun, and also a few showers scattered through the week. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of August, highs again 20 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, trying to introduce this week's guest, and joining us this week's Conservative Councillor for Froome Valley, Leslie Alexander. Hi Leslie, welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, your party leadership at Westminster and here in Bristol are two very different things. Do you ever feel embarrassed about what they're doing with the global economy? Because things aren't really going too well for George Osborne right now.
No, I'm not embarrassed. And let's face it, George inherited a really difficult situation and he's doing the best he can with it. I think he's doing very well.
Okay. Also, what about your role on the City Council? You are a councillor, but for Froome Vale, for the Conservative Party. But what's your role on the committees and that kind of thing?
I'm on the Health Scrutiny Committee. I'm chairman, and I'm also on planning and a number of smaller committees as well.
Now, I know the Lib Dems run the council, and is it the case that the chairs of all of the scrutiny committees are other parties, or do the Lib Dems also chair some of those?
I think they've got one planning committee, but other than that, no, there are other parties.
Because this is something that worries me a bit. You know, you think that it would be the opposition parties that would chair the scrutiny committees, and that seems to be slowly changing. I think for the very first, once they very first had this cabinet system, it was always the sort of the done thing that that these scrutiny committees were chaired by opposition parties. So, I mean, surely it's no point in having a scrutiny committee if it's chaired by a Liberal Democrat.
I quite agree with you. And up until about the last 2 years, it was always opposition parties. Well, then the Liberal Democrats had the majority and they changed things. But as one of the things that Labour and Conservatives demanded this time in exchange for their support to allow the Liberal Democrats to run the council was that the scrutiny committees should be chaired by the opposition. So they're shared equally between Conservative and Labour, and the vice chair is the opposite.
So as chairing the Health Scrutiny Committee, that's quite an important role, isn't it?
It's certainly a lively one.
So can you tell us some of the issues you've been dealing with over the last few weeks?
We've had to deal with a lot with the changes to social services and the cuts that they're having to make and the changes that they want to make on that.
And how have you found that? I mean, do you find as a scrutiny committee that you're able to go in there and say, hang on a minute, you're cutting from the wrong budget there, you're cutting the wrong service?
We can certainly say what we think. Whether it will be actually be reflected in the final decision remains to be seen.
Because it would be a bit disillusioning, wouldn't it, and very bad morale for you lot if it was just a talking shop.
Yes, it would. I think I have to say that for the most part they're pretty good about listening to us, and certainly the health service for the most part is, although we've had a recent problem with the PET scanner that is moving from Bristol to Cheltenham, and it was virtually a fait accompli before it came to us, and there have been a lot of comments on that one. And
so what is a PET scanner? I think it's not for dogs and cats, is
no,
it?
It's not. It's scanning. It's a scanner for, sorry, I shouldn't have used jargon. It's for scanning some of the, well, they say that it's the rarer cancers, but in fact, it's also used for some of the more common cancers as well. And people might have to make journeys to Cheltenham on several occasions for these scanners, and what we're concerned about in Bristol, that it's those that either can't afford to go, or not so much that can't afford, because those people are catered for, but it's the people that just fall outside of those sort of parameters to get help, or in a lot of cases the people that perhaps aren't confident to travel as far as Cheltenham.
But it's also a little bit annoying, isn't it? I mean, Bristol's a much bigger city than Cheltenham. Why should they have this scanner and not us?
Yes, you're quite right on that one, and that's one of the arguments that we have.
Okay, and what about in Froome Vale? What sort of issues are coming up, you know, as part of your ward, work with your ward in Froome Vale?
Travel is taking up an awful lot of my time at the moment, because we've got the bus lane, of course, which has been very controversial and we don't want. But also, on the other side of the ward, they're looking at the rapid transport system, and whilst the funding for a park and ride on the M32 isn't included in the current funding, they are spending about £6 million, we understand, on a bridge and on the road to nowhere to try and to hopefully anticipate funding in the future, and then they want to concrete over the best agricultural land in the city.
Now, it does seem a little bit strange, doesn't it, that we're having to cope with all these cutbacks and all sorts of things like elderly people's care, and yet there is money to build a road to nowhere.
Exactly, and that is something that should not be happening. Neither should the £1.9 million that they're proposing to spend on fish ponds. Just because the money is there doesn't mean to say it has to be spent on something that is not needed. because it's taxpayers' money and there are a lot of other things. We know that it can't be just transferred to something else in Bristol, but that is no reason to spend it because it's there.
Now, the Chair of Transport, Tim Kent, Lib Dem, if he was here, would be telling you now, Leslie, look, transport is a massive priority in this city, as everybody's sitting in their cars now going 2 miles an hour or maybe even no miles an hour will tell us. And so what he's done is he's built this showcase bus route, and that's what what people need is decent public transport to take the weight off of people who are in their cars, so people can actually leave their cars at home if they want to.
We didn't have a problem before they started building bus stops that protrude into the roads. Now we do have a problem. That's exactly what's happening. People are sitting in their cars, pumping out fumes, trying to get past buses to go out of fish ponds. Fish ponds itself isn't the problem. At its worst, on a really bad day, the traffic only takes 35 seconds longer than it should do, and that's on a bad day, to go through fish ponds. So our argument has always been that it should start after Lodge Causeway. That 35 seconds is what costing £1.9 million. Is that a good use of taxpayers' money? We are told that when the bus gets to fish ponds, at the beginning of fish ponds, it can be up to 14 minutes late. But that delay is caused much further back in the chain, probably around the Yate area. That's where it should be addressed, not 35 seconds in fish ponds.
Well, Tim will say the logic here is, look, if we hold the cars back, then the buses are more likely to be arriving on time.
Yes, but 35 seconds in fish ponds?
I think you made your point, Leslie. Right, let's introduce Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, this week's been a little bit weird, particularly the last couple of days, with the question mark over Italy and Spain. Billions daily now are being wiped off stock markets in Asia, Europe and the United States. For how long?
Well, we're teetering on the brink of a major collapse. I mean, let's not kid ourselves, this is a very serious situation, probably the most serious we've faced since the Second World War.
So why is that? How have we come here to be on the brink? Surely we shouldn't be on the brink.
You know, I'm just going to bang my usual drum, which is the deregulation of financial markets in the 1980s is the root cause of our problems. And I'm afraid that there's been no reality about the situation for the last 2 years. Whoever's been in government, everybody has bought into the idea that we've got to resurrect the private banking system, even though it's dead. The banks are effectively bust, and that includes Barclays, because they're holding loads of CDOs for the other banks.
What are these CDOs?
Well, collateralised debt obligations. In other words, these complex derivative trades that they've been building up over the last few years.
And that
years.
Have been deregulated.
Well, exactly. The whole point is that deregulation has turned into a very, very sour situation for everybody. And once the banks were propped up in 2008, there needed to be some really serious leadership from the top, and I'm thinking here of the US president, to get to grips with what needed to be done. I mean, Roosevelt in the 30s, he said, give me 100 days and I will do what I can to try and solve the problem, and he got stormed in there and he said, Wall Street will hate me but I welcome their hatred. Now, I'm afraid Obama has not been like that at all. He's been a very big disappointment. The deal that's just been signed in the US is actually a rather stupid deal, which is actually going to crash the economy.
But it's what you want. You were saying that's what you wanted last week.
No. The deal was just to keep... if they hadn't done the deal in the US last week, the economy would have crashed over the... But what's happened is, with both the euro deal and the dollar deal, the markets have started to look for the weaknesses in those deals. Now, in actual fact, that doing the deals was just a way of preventing the house from falling on everybody's heads. But the house is still collapsing, even though these deals have put it off by... It looks like the euro deal has lasted 2 weeks and the dollar deal has lasted... Well, we'll see how long it lasts. Now, the fact is that those deals are emergency deals that you do at the very last minute just to try and swerve the car out of the crash. But we're definitely going to crash one way or another. That's always been coming.
We're coming up to the markets closing now and the weekend. We've had 2 days of massive falls, billions being wiped off.
The real scary thing is that the Asian stock markets have caught the flu as well. That's what they were really worried about this morning. Are the Asian stock markets going to catch it? And they have.
Now, you're talking about this as a flu, as a virus. I mean, you know, to what extent are the markets really that unstable that they can catch a virus and keel
over? The markets are incredibly unstable and interlinked. And the fact of the matter is, since Mexico defaulted in 1982, the default of just one major country, I mean, and it could even be a smaller country as Ireland, can bring down the entire banking system. Now, it's absurd to have got ourselves into a situation like that, but this is the result of the deregulation of financial markets. The regulation of financial markets, which separated retail banking from investment banking, was brought in the 1930s to prevent precisely what has happened. But in the Clinton administration in the 1990s, repealed the Glass-Steagall Act under Wall Street pressure, and therefore they brought the investment banking back into retail banking. I know, Leslie, you used to be a retail banker, didn't you? That's what you used to do. And the retail banks actually are fairly stable and solid, and they always were. But they, of course, we've now got contagion from this shadow banking market, which is and it's everybody's responsible for this, because we've all allowed this to happen. But I'm afraid we are in a very serious situation now. Nobody's quite sure what to do.
Leslie, as someone that's worked in banking, what are your thoughts about all this? Because it seems like there's this kind of thing out there called the market, which is almost like an animal. You're never quite sure how it's going to react. And the last couple of days, the market has been absolutely hitting the bottom.
It hasn't hit the bottom yet.
It's starting
to wobble, that's all.
It's now heading for the bottom. And I wonder what your analysis of this is and how you think it can be sorted out.
Oh, good heavens.
That's a big question.
I've just said
nobody knows the answer, so why should listen?
The thing is, I'm giving Leslie the opportunity here, because most of us have never worked in banking. We've got no idea of how the actual money system works. So, I mean, if you were, you had George Osborne's ear now, you had his mobile number on his holiday, wherever he is at the moment, maybe in the Mediterranean somewhere, what would you be saying to him?
Oh, right. Where do I start?
Well, I mean, you've heard Martin's analysis. I'm just interested, as you, someone that's actually worked in banking, I mean, how do you see all this going? Because we can't just simply be at the mercy of the markets. That's not good enough, is it?
No, we can't. And it is the investment banking side of it that's caused all the problems, as Martin has said. The euro as well has caused a lot of the problems, mm-hmm. because an awful lot of countries fudged the statistics to get into the euro, and that's the one thing that I can thank Gordon Brown for. Not much, but one thing, mm-hmm. is that he didn't take us into it. So now we're now looking at countries like Greece and Spain and people and Italy that did fudge their responsibilities.
Well, the obvious thing to say at that point is, pretty surely we need protectionism. But this is not what the markets want, and this is not what we're being told. You know, the free market wants that is to put up a sort of financial wall around the pound and around Britain, and to say, well, hang on a minute, we're just going to manage our own affairs. Let these other currencies go where they want, but we're going to manage the pound.
And I'm not quite sure in the big scheme of things how easy or even possible it would be to do that.
Martin, what do you think? Is that likely or not?
Well, no. Well, you can see that the FTSE 100 has taken a beating this afternoon. And that is because British banks are heavily exposed to the Eurozone countries. Yeah. So, I mean, Britain is one of probably the second most important financial centre in the world after Wall Street. Everything that happens in the world outside affects us, or affects the city. So we're very much at the front of the roller coaster ride. We're sitting in the front car, and we always have been.
There was a whole thing of the Eurozone and other markets in other parts of the world in the Observer last Sunday, and it was rather frustrating because they had every country in Europe was listed as what's going to happen to it, apart from the UK. What's going to happen to us?
It's delusionary for the UK to imagine that a crash in the Eurozone and a crash in America is a good news for Britain. That's absurd, because obviously there are customers, we're all intimately linked to them. The British banks are exposed to all of the troubles that are happening. So gloating at other people's misfortune is a rather silly. We really are all in this together, and when it crashes, we're all going to pay the consequences. And Britain is on its own is unable to steer the world economy, but we do have a fairly influential voice. You know, we're fairly big players, and we need common sense from people about the situation. I don't believe, Leslie, and I'd say this to a Labour front bencher who's saying, I don't believe that you can cut your way out of this crisis. You can't. Spending money doesn't solve the problem either. But if you're in a car crash, cutting your own throat doesn't stop the car crash. You just cut your own throat, and then the car crashes. And I'm afraid that we're now really need. leadership from the US in particular. Yeah, we needed Obama to get a grip, and I'm afraid he is now politically neutered
by the
Republican Congress.
But that isn't happening, is it? And the other thing, of course, is that the IMF, we've got Christine Lagarde is also in trouble now.
She's very much a Wall Street person.
She's in trouble now. Before her, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who's been hit with this court case in New York, she now looks like, in the not-too-distant future, has got a court case against her coming up. So the IMF looks a little bit as if it's a little bit unstable as well.
It's not just the fact the personnel of the IMF, it's the policies that have been pursued over the years. I mean, basically, we've had 30 years of free market fundamentalism until suddenly the banks have to be rescued by the government. And that, at that moment, when the banks are rescued by the government, we're not in Kansas anymore. The free market philosophy is dead from that moment. But as a commentator, Michel Chossudovsky, who's an economist in Canada, said last week, when the banks collapsed in 2008, they weren't nationalised. What has happened is that the state is being privatised to keep the banking system going. Now, that is way, way the wrong way to go. The banks have been bailed out, and they've used the money that they've been bailed out with to then lobby for further things that they want with our own money. Now, at a certain point, and especially if it does crash, people all over the world are going to get very, very angry, and we're going to see political extremism of all kinds. You know, there'll be left-wing extremism, there'll be right-wing extremism. That's exactly what happened in the 30s, and that's a very scary prospect.
But to what extent is the pound cushioning us from the eurozone and the dollar?
I agree with Leslie that we shouldn't be at the euro. The euro was one size fits all. And this was an accident waiting to happen. But the real problems are the euro might have been viable under other circumstances had it been put together in a different kind of way. But we are where we are. If the euro collapses, and I suspect it will, that could happen in the next week or so, that the euro will basically collapse.
But Does that mean it splits into the old currencies?
I mean, even for Tory Eurosceptics, that's not good news. I mean, failure in other countries will wash back over us.
Of course.
Whether you know, if they get it wrong, then that has consequences for us.
Does that mean it splits into the old currencies, like the dinar or the lira?
Nobody's quite sure how this works. I mean, people have talked about the idea of the Greeks going back to the drachma. The problem for that is that there has to be the Greek central bank has to decide to go for the drachma with agreement with their own government, and presumably clear it with the ECB and the European Commission, and then they've got to spring it on the market so quickly that people can't take all their money out of the banks in Greece, because that's what they'll do. Yeah, if you're going to have all of your euros turned into drachma tomorrow, you take them out as euros now. Yeah, and that starts a run on the Greek banks, which then starts a run on the British banks, which then starts a run on the banks. I stress what I said earlier: the banks are bust, and there's been complete denial about this. They're using Enron-style accounting, including Barclays, to pretend that they are making profits. If they had to mark to market all the junk that they hold, they would all be insolvent.
So
not just
banks,
illiquid,
Martin,
insolvent.
If these banks are bust, why can't the Treasury simply, if there's any shenanigans and problems from these banks, they could just take them over for nothing, surely?
Well, indeed they could, but that would require a political will and a vision, and that's precisely what we're lacking. The politicians are still playing the old game of, you know, let's mudge and fudge and try and come to a compromise about something that we've somehow stick our fingers in the dike, and we've reached the point now where we've been sticking our fingers in the dike, but the dike's going to break and fingers won't do anymore. And the real hope for change was when Obama was elected 2 years ago. If he had got a grip, we might not be in this situation,
okay,
but I'm afraid he didn't.
All right, so you're saying there's no hope. But what I'm
no,
saying
I'm not saying
is
there's no hope. I'm just saying this is the situation we're in. It's pretty
what is the hope then, Martin? Come
well, the on. Hope from my point of view is that once we have had a proper crash, I mean, the real free market right, the von Mises and von Hayek's and so on, and the von Mises Institute have been saying all along, we should have let the banks collapse. And as a left-wing economist, I've got a great deal of sympathy with that view. If banks go bust, perhaps they should just go down the drain, just like mining industries, just like car industries, whatever. But they've become a special case because they've made themselves indispensable. It's like being in a room with a suicide bomber with a suicide belt on. And they can destroy themselves and they can destroy you at the same time. So you just have to talk nicely to them. That's how we've ended up. But we should, I mean, as the Irish say, I wouldn't start from here if I were you.
Okay, I'll give you the final word on this, Leslie, because I want you to convince us that George Osborne is the man to sort this out.
I think he is. He's done an awful lot of good things about with the economy, and I think he's on the right lines.
Well, one thing for certain is it looks as if our credit rating may have been less if he hadn't been cutting the way he had. But anyway, one of the consequences of all this is it's kind of coming right up against the situation where we've got a demographic time bomb as well coming along, which is people living longer and longer and a lot of pressure on pensions. Marina Morris.
Hello. Are we designed to live to 100? By 2066, the DWP estimates that there will be at least 500,000 people aged over 100. Today's 20-year-olds are three times more likely to live to 100 than their grandparents and twice as likely as their parents, official figure shows. A baby born in 2011 is almost eight times more likely to reach their 100th birthday than one born 8 years ago. A girl born this year has a 1 in 3 chance of reaching 100 years old, and boys have a 1 in 4 chances. The phenomenon of Britain's aging population will impact on everything from pensions to the National Health Service. Pensions Minister Steve Webb says that the dramatic speed at which life expectancy is changed means that we need to radically rethink our perceptions about our later lives. We simply can't look to our grandparents' experience of retirement as a model for our own. We will live longer and we will have to save more money. The models on which our welfare system are built, such as state pensions, depends on the young of today supporting the elderly in return for their promise that the young of tomorrow will return the favor and support them. As even greater percentage of population age, there must be a tipping point where this model becomes unsustainable. When state pensions were introduced in 1909, they were means tested, but there was a generation who paid in nothing but received benefits. There could be a generation who paid in all their lives and get nothing out. The only guarantee in the future is change. This dramatic increase in life expectancy will face health bankruptcy. The harsh truth is that by 2048, advanced in medicine, a better ordered society, and even huge amounts of care being provided by the young elderly will not be enough to help care for our rising population of the very old. If the statisticians are right, 1/6 of the current British population will live to be centenarians. Unfortunately, many trapped in bodies with physical and mental disabilities. Biologically, we are designed to live at least 100 years. But we need to change our perception of our later lives and create a new model and lifestyle to achieve not only longevity, but quality of life and health. They are both valued.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Leslie Alexander, Conservative councillor, this is a bit of a weird dilemma, this, isn't it? Because you would think everyone would be celebrating. You know, we're all living older and older. Isn't it wonderful? But no. Unfortunately, we've got to be depressed about it because we can't afford any longer to pay people's pensions.
Yes, we have got a problem here. We've very much a time bomb. And I'm not sure exactly how we're going to manage. I mean, quality of life is, it's all very well living to 100, but quality of life's got to go in there somewhere. And if you haven't got quality of life, if you've got very bad health, or if you've got no perception of what is happening, then there's no quality of life, and there's no point in living to 100. But unless the government brings in something like the right to take a life, then, and not saying I advocate that, but I can't really see that there's another way around it.
Yeah. Well, okay. What's your position on that then? Because that's quite a controversial idea, isn't it? This whole assisted suicide business. Do you think it's okay to kind of have someone come and help somebody die in that sort of situation?
I think it's very difficult. If you've got a relative that wants to die, is going to go through a very horrible death if they don't, but they're afraid to ask their relatives to help them because they might be prosecuted afterwards. It is a very, very difficult position to be in. And you've got to protect everybody. I mean, there are some relatives out there that might be quite glad to see Aunt Flo or whoever pass on because they're waiting for an inheritance. But mostly people are not like that. They really want to help people.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, you may be in a bad mood one day and think, oh, I've had enough of this, I want to die. Yeah. But then if you're okay, and then you're dead, if you die after that, you can't go back on it, can you?
Even if you're having a bad...
It's a little bit, maybe a little bit like the whole situation, which has also been brought up in the news this week, which is to do with the death penalty.
Yeah.
And the reason that the death penalty was gotten rid of was because they were finding that quite a lot of people who had been hanged back in the 1950s hadn't actually done it. And of course, once they've been hanged, there's no way you can go back on that. Martin, what's your thoughts about the economics of this time bomb? Can we be happy about the fact we're living longer? Or is it just impossible?
We ought to be, and in actual fact, productivity in a well-functioning capitalist economy should grow at 3% a year, roughly. And therefore, we should have more resources to resolve more problems. If you think about how wealthy we are as a society in total now, compared to how we were even 10 years ago, I mean, growth at 3% a year leads pretty quickly to a doubling in the size of the
economy. But hasn't all that been on tick?
Well, no, the problem is that it's all concentrated. We have to talk about distribution. We're going to have to talk about distribution and redistribution. The top 1% of people in Britain own 50% of the wealth, something like that. The bottom 50% have 6% of the wealth, and that's all concentrated in the top decile. In other words, there are at least a third of the people in the country who have no wealth at all. Nothing. No savings. Now, capitalism can only work if you redistribute. You have a rough and tumble game where some people do well and other people do badly, but at the end of the game, it's like a game of darts. You wipe the board clean and you give everybody enough money to keep the system going. Real wages in the United States of America have not risen since 1973, and people have made up the shortfall by borrowing. Now, when capitalism was working well from 1945 to 1973, productivity increases in the workplace were reflected in people's wage packets. And I remember I was a child in the 1960s. We didn't have as much stuff as we do now, a fraction of the stuff that we do now. But at the same time, people had an optimism about the future. They knew that their wages were going to rise year on year, that they would have more opportunities, for example, opportunities to travel abroad. I remember when my family first traveled abroad. You know, I remember when the first television arrived in my house. I'm that old. And people are not confident about the future anymore because we've lost the will to redistribute. And conservative governments used to understand this as well. I'm thinking of the Macmillan government and that kind of era.
But this whole business of wiping the slate clean, surely that's just not realistic.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not realistic to imagine anybody's going to pay this mountain of debt which has been built up as on paper. As Keynes said in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not a political point. It's not being truculent and throwing your rattle out of the pram. It's just a fact. Greece is not going to pay the debt. And giving money to the Greeks to pretend that they're paying the debt is just basically fiddling while Rome burns. And ultimately, a lot of this money is going to have to be written off. And that means that the bondholders, the wealthy classes, are going to have to take a hit. In Norway, which was in the news last week, everybody in Norway, their tax return is available on the internet. So I could say to you, Leslie Alexander, I know exactly how much you're worth by going, click, you're worth this. Now, that does lead to people getting aware of who's got the dosh and who hasn't. All of this stuff about, oh, we've got an older generation, we can't afford this, we can't afford that. Once people know how the distribution of wealth and income really looks, they suddenly think, hang on a minute, some people have got a hell of a lot and some people have got hardly anything.
But Martin, that's not very British, is it?
No, it is. It's as British as the Second World War. In the Second World War, the wealthy classes were made to pay their way, and the top rate of tax in Britain during the conservative 1950s and in conservative America during the 1950s was 96%. And that's because at the same time as the wealthy classes were paying 96%, the boys were fighting in Korea and other places and paying with blood for their citizenship. Citizenship, if you're a member of a society, there are rules and regulations, there are rights and responsibilities.
But ultimately, are people's pensions actually going to pay out at the end of the day?
If the banks crash and we go through where we're going now, no, is a simple answer. And Marina will know what happened in the former Soviet Union with people who paid into their pension plans for years and years and years. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, they were then left with nothing, having paid maybe 50%. I mean, I used to live in Poland. People paid 50% of their salaries as their pension contribution. And then at the end of that, having paid 50% of their salary for 25, 30 years, they're told there's nothing for you. That made people mad. And it's not surprising, is it?
Well, Marina's been out on the streets asking you what you think of the cuts to pensions and other ways we're being affected by what's known as this demographic time bomb. Even though you think it was good news that we're all living longer, apparently not.
Up to 200 elderly people living in three Southern Cross homes in and around Bristol could be affected by the transfer responsibility to landlords. What should happen to the vulnerable residents and staff, and who should run these homes when Southern Cross no longer exists?
These people, they've worked so hard. It's important that they have the best quality of care at this time of life.
It's got to be private landlords who have community at heart, and if they don't have community at heart, they shouldn't touch it, and it shouldn't be in for profit, it should be in to actually solve the problem. Because we're all going to get old one day.
The old people are mistreated these days, and it needs to change. They will get old one day.
Government should take over, really, and they should definitely be given homes as soon as possible. Make sure they're looked after, sort of vulnerable.
So I think the government or local authorities certainly should step in.
It's kind of the care of the government, shouldn't it be, if people are going to be evicted?
Should the family, the state or the private sector care for the elderly when they can no longer look after themselves?
If a person can stay at home, they can stay at home, because some people, they actually deteriorate when they're moved into a residential home and they just give up the ghost and then they die sooner than they would. They deserve respect. I have actually worked in residential units and it's really, really sad. The only time that relatives seem to be really interested to come along is when the person died, to see what they can get.
We are from Pakistan. The elderly are revered very much. The most elderly would be looked after by their children. There is no concept of them living under elderly care. The ideal situation would be if the children themselves could look after them. I know that's not always possible. So in a country like Britain, where they have a lot of social services network, I think it should fall upon the state rather than on a private company. It's very important on how the children look upon the elderly. If they look upon the elderly in terms of logic, they're not producing anything, they're not contributing. But if you think of them as somebody that needs to be taken care of, who have taken care of you when you were young and brought you up, it's not about economics, it's about what's the right thing, I think.
I think, well, the family really should.
They're not in a position to, then.
Yeah, then I think it's down to the state.
Yeah. Are the health problems of old age inevitable? And what is the impact of unhealthy lifestyle choices on the quality of life in old age?
Some people can't help it because health-wise it just happens, but a lot of people don't help themselves. They should be out and they should try and exercise not just their body but also their mind. And laugh a lot.
I certainly think old age is determined that people are going to have higher risk of illness and disease and things like that. The impact of what their healthy lifestyle choices is, it's very difficult for somebody in an older age to change their lifestyle. We've all known that lifestyle has to change. You have to change your healthier lifestyle in a younger environment. I certainly think for an older person that's far more difficult to do.
If you've lived an unhealthy lifestyle all your life, you're going to definitely have health problems in your old age. Things like smoking, drinking too much, not getting enough exercise. Keeping, I think a huge part of keeping your mind active as well in old age is a huge... maybe education from a younger age into the negative effects of tobacco and alcohol and drugs.
Well, that was Marina Morris out on the streets asking you what you think about all the various problems to do with the ageing demographics or increasing age of people who are in retirement. Now, Conservative Councillor Leslie Alexander, what we're hearing there, one of the aspects of what people are saying is that they are saying, well, actually, maybe in the future it's going to be the children that look after elderly people rather than the local authority. So do you think that's the case? I mean, because for many Conservatives, they see the sort of socialist way of doing things as a nanny state and a negative thing.
I think that families should, where they can, help out. But if a family decides that an older person needs to go into a home, and there are people that want to do that, then... If that person, my own personal view is that if that person can pay, then they should pay rather than expect the state to pay so that they can leave their money to their families. It's a difficult one thing, I know, and people will look at it in that, well, I've saved all my life and I've got some money, somebody else has spent every penny they earn and they haven't got anything, and the state still picks up the bill. So that's a very difficult one to handle. People certainly, the idea now is that we shouldn't put so many people into homes. We should keep them in their their own homes as long as possible, and that is the way that the all local authorities and the government are going at the moment. And certainly it's better, I think, for people to be in their homes, but they do also need some sort of social life, otherwise they'll just moulder and die. They do need something to stimulate them. But there are a lot of organisations, the third sector, that charities, churches, who are doing some brilliant work, and they need to be funded if the person can't afford to pay for it themselves, because they do keep people alert and alive, and that is where their health stays static rather than deteriorate.
But I mean, aren't we moving towards this sort of third world model where people have as many children as they can because they're scared they may not be looked after in later life?
Not amongst British people. It might be a third world. Yes, I think it probably is a third world idea. And we do get, when people come to this country to live, they are still having lots of children. But I think anybody that's been here for any length of time, two children, you're replacing yourself. Any more than that is something that we can't afford anymore.
And it's put across by some people as one of the reasons why we've got quite a big population explosion going on in the world. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about this whole sort of balance between the nanny state and children looking after elderly people?
I think Leslie put her finger on the nub of the problem. Middle-class people save to pass on the inheritance to their children. But if you look at what's the situation in Scotland, they've clearly made a policy decision there that the state will pick up the bill for people who are in homes and so on and so forth. Now, the logical corollary of that is that you have to raise taxes on those who have the money to make sure that everybody is guaranteed that help. And I think the problem with means testing it is that you then have a disincentive to people to save. And this is happening in people in my family, where they've saved for years, and now actually all of that money is now being, because people, you know, it's very expensive. It's hundreds of pounds a week to be in a care home. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much money you've saved, it doesn't take long to run through it if you're going spending hundreds of pounds a week. And of course that then undermines the whole ethic of saving to pass on to one's children. And I think this is the heart of the dilemma. And I think I believe in a welfare state which everybody pays in and everybody takes out. So no matter how wealthy you are guaranteed care by the state. But of course the corollary of that is you will pay your taxes all the way, and then you will get your, and everybody will get at the end of the day the support that they need, and those who want to pass on their inherited wealth to their children
inheritance taxes, Martin, was a Labour Party thing, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, ultimately at the end
that
of
was the biggest disincentive
at the end of the day,
to
there is always a tension between what you might call distributive justice of giving everybody a fair go, and also recognising that some people work hard and save and all the rest of it, and you don't want to have a disincentive to people to save. But ultimately, I would like a society. I mean, in the Second World War, I feel that we were fighting for a society where everybody would be looked after, no matter what their social rank, no matter. And when we're talking about things like healthcare, I think the poorest in our society deserve the very best, as the richest do. We all deserve healthcare because that's a human right, and I think that's an important aspect of my thinking and a part of the British way of life, I think, actually. I mean, the National Health Service, I mean, whatever the reforms are going on, we could argue whether the reforms are good or bad, but I believe that the Conservative Party does believe in the National Health Service. They claim that they do. And that's because it's a central part of the way we think about ourselves, is it not?
After the next story, and the Lib Dems are to vote on decriminalising all drug use. This is in today's Independent newspaper, or maybe tomorrow's. You can never quite tell on the internet if it says it's today's date. The Liberal Democrats are to call for the decriminalisation of all drugs, including heroin and cocaine, to be considered urgently by the coalition government in an effort to cut levels of addiction. The party's conference is preparing to back demands for Britain's harmful and ineffective drug laws, but dating back 40 years, to be swept away, replaced with an entirely new strategy for tackling drug use. Nick Clegg, Deputy Prime Minister, who's previously supported drug decriminalisation, is understood to be relaxed about his party committing itself to such a contentious policy proposal. Now, Leslie Alexander, you're a Conservative, you're in coalition at Westminster with the Lib Dems. Is this something that you think is a realistic prospect? Is something that the Lib Dems have won the Conservatives over on, decriminalising drugs?
I suspect not. I mean, we hear a lot about some countries, Holland and others, that have already decriminalised drugs. But are they has it actually improved things? They say that there hasn't been a greater use of drugs, but has there been a lot less? I don't think so.
Well, the argument, my argument anyway, being the Key Largo, this old 1940s film with Humphrey Bogart, is that the biggest thing that the organised crime is frightened of is this kind of decriminalising their black markets. And they are really scared that the government is going to come along, as they were with Prohibition in the US, and actually decriminalise this market, which has made them so much money. So what do you say to that?
Well, if that really works, then I suppose that it could be a good one, but I don't think it's going to.
Martin.
Yeah, I think it's very brave of the Liberals to bring this forward. I mean, when Bob Ainsworth, who is a former Blairite minister, suggested that we might debate the idea of decriminalising drugs, he was immediately slapped down by Ed Miliband, who's supposedly a left-winger. This is a very contentious topic, as you know. But as an economist, I would point out that the UN committee, it's the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, gave a report in 2008 where they pointed out that as the banks wobbled in 2008, the drug cartels went to the banks and said, "You're short of money, chaps, aren't you? Guess what? We've got loads of it." And there was a big sucking sound, and all of the illegal money that had been sitting there was sucked into the banks to prop up the banking system. Now, in actual fact, our banking system is absolutely dependent on dirty drug money. And the problem is not so much drug taking. Drug taking has gone on for thousands of years. They found a cannabis pipe in South Africa, 40,000 years old. The fact of the problem is, the fundamental problem is the corruption of the dirty money. And people look at this from the wrong end. Now, I'm not suggesting for one minute that drugs are good for you. They are not. We had a discussion about ketamine, didn't we, the other week? And it's not good for you. It's a silly thing to do. And that's what young people should be told.
It's
a silly thing to do.
It's not cool.
It's not cool. No, it makes you look like a fool, as I've seen in some parties with people using it. But, I mean, the point is that we've got to have a realistic debate about this, and I think that's welcome. And I think this is not going to change easily, because there's lots of hardline attitudes on all sides about this. But we need to have a mature adult discussion about this, just as you might have a mature adult discussion with a teenager that was experimenting with drugs in your own family. You've got to have a serious adult discussion with them, and we've got to have a serious adult discussion as a society about this, because it's a really big issue, massive issue, and it's actually an issue about organised crime. That's what I see as the central point, as you pointed out to me.
Well, one of the sort of tail end of this article, it says, under the 1971 Misuse of Drugs Act, illicit substances are divided into three categories: possession of Class A drugs, which include heroin, cocaine, crack cocaine, ecstasy and LSD, carry the harshest penalties. Class B drugs include cannabis and amphetamines, while such as substances as ketamine, GHB, tranquilizers and anabolic steroids are in Class C. Critics say the categories do not accurately reflect the risks of the different substances and therefore carry little credibility.
Can I just make a point, Tony? We're talking about decriminalisation here, and in actual fact, decriminalisation allows the illegal market to continue to operate. So in actual fact, it takes the pressure off. They've done this in Portugal. People are allowed to have drugs as long as it's for personal use, but the illegal market continues to exist. And I think the illegal market is the issue, which is why you have to have full legalisation and regulation, because that gets the criminals out of it completely.
Well, we shall see if the Conservatives go along with this particular
policy. Some Conservatives do agree with this. So certainly the libertarian right-wingers understand this, but Milton Friedman was all in favour of liberalising drug laws.
Okay, and on to Libya now. It's the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and to mark it, NATO have wheeled out one of their big guns this week. That big gun being Wing Commander Mike Bracken, MBE.
The effect of Ramadan is we need to wait and see whether the Gaddafi forces continue to shell and inflict harm on the people of Libya. If they do, and we believe that there is risk to the lives of the Libyan people, to the men, women and children, could be slaughtered or attacked, then I think it would be highly appropriate for the protection of those lives to continue. And NATO would use the mandate that it has to protect those lives.
Now, Martin, that was Wing Commander Mike Bracken from NATO there. Protecting lives? Is that really what NATO are up to?
No, they're attempting regime change. Now, whether you think that's a good or a bad idea, it's a regime change policy. Now, that is not what Britain said, and the France and others said when they went to the United Nations Security Council, which is why major countries like France, like Russia and China abstained, because they were, if you remember, I was asked at the time, and I said, well, no-fly zone, there was a no-fly zone in Bosnia when I was an aid worker there, a no-fly zone is a no-fly zone. This isn't a no-fly zone, it's a regime change policy. There's no UN mandate for that whatsoever, none whatsoever.
Well, what about you? We're going to hear from a Libyan student in, from London in a minute, but what are your thoughts about this, Leslie, about the way that this whole policy is going in Libya?
To be perfectly honest, I haven't given it an awful lot of thought, because there's been too many other things.
Because it's kind of dragged on a bit, hasn't it? It started in March. We were told it was all going to be very quick, and that that NATO was in there to protect civilians. Now we've had now thousands of civilian casualties, and this is it seems as if it's got no end in sight with the rebels. And also, yes, as you were about to say there, it's costing a lot of money, isn't it?
We can't afford it, no.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to a Libyan student from London. In the meantime, what are Libyans studying here in the UK? What do they think about NATO's mission to protect civilians? I spoke to a London-based Libyan student, Asil, earlier today.
My name is Asil. I'm 19 years old. I'm studying in England and university. I've been awarded a scholarship by the Libyan government, just like the other 5,500 Libyan students here, because I've done well in my academic years back in Libya. Obviously, we consider England education as one of the most prestigious systems in the world. But the money I get, the scholarship, now because England has given the Libyan embassy to the NTC, the money that I'm supposed to be funding at my university and the other students' university will just go tomorrow to buy arms for these rebels and Islamist extremists. Unless the NTC goes back to the legitimate government, Tripoli's government, I don't think I can continue my studies here. And I doubt that any of the other students will come back. Most medias, when they speak about Libya, you only hear about the coastal parts of Libya. It's either Benghazi, Sirte, Misrata or Tripoli, and all these cities are on the coast. Libya is a very big country, so it's got vast spaces. And the only parts that are controlled by the rebel are Benghazi and its surroundings. Misrata, yes, they are fighting here and there, and in the Western Mountains, but I can't really say that they're in control there. They're continuously fighting. The country's not being divided, but there is division within Benghazi. The Transitional Council is in division between people who are liberal and people who are Islamist extremists. The way I see it now is it's become more of a triangle fight. It's not about East versus West anymore. All I can say about the West helping the rebels, because, I mean, we go back to the 1973 United Nations resolution where they help many to, go inside and protect civilians. There is more like protecting the rebels. And now, because of NATO, the way they're bombing continuously, Gaddafi now is by far powerful than any other time. And the only reason is NATO bombings. NATO has made Gaddafi stronger. If you watch Libyan State TV, you can see every single day masses of people going on the streets. And it's, on Fridays, you can see that there's the numbers just triple every single week. And I consider the rebels now, they are NATO's ground troops. It's not they're protecting civilians, but they're just protecting the rebels. Over the years, over the centuries and decades, we've met so many invasions, from the Ottomans to the Italians. In 1951, when Libya was independent, we were separated into three states. The colour of the rebel flag is green, black and red, and those are the colours of each state, where black is the south, red is the east, and green is the west. People, we don't want to go back 42 years in the past. We do not like invasion. We like to be free. Our country has been, for the last 42 years, has been free of any military base, foreign military bases. We enjoy that. I mean, if we compare ourselves to the other Arab states, for instance, we bring Qatar. Qatar means a small island, and pretty much half of it is a military base. The same thing goes on with Saudi Arabia, and the same thing goes on with the UAE. Probably for that reason is why we don't want foreign intervention, we don't want foreign military bases, we definitely don't want a military invasion. For that reason is why Gaddafi has become so much powerful. Because I do not want foreign intervention in my country. I do not want my country to be destroyed completely. I mean, it's already been bombed. Having troops on the ground will fully like change this country, which has been built for the last 40 years, into look at Iraq now. It is completely destroyed, and NATO ground troops in Libya will have the same outcome. Democracy, you can't bomb democracy into the country, and because of that, I would stand next to Gaddafi. But I mean, we can't wash blood with blood. We can't continue on the fighting. We're all Libyans in the end. And over the table, if we can all get to one table, we can definitely agree. But the National Translator Council is not independent. It's definitely being navigated by foreign countries. I want the National Transition Council to step out, first of all. When 30 countries say that the NTC is a legitimate representative of the Libyan people, I would disagree, because I did not elect that. I don't want Mustafa Abdeljalil or any of the others to represent me, myself or my fellow Libyans. I would definitely speak for my friends, because we were speaking with them early on, and they were like, no, we did not elect that. Who appointed them to represent us? I would like the NTC to step out, and because of Libya is a very tribal country, to have the elders of these tribes to meet up on one table, or whatever we want, we'll figure out. There's nothing they could ask for that could not be given.
That was 19-year-old Libyan student based in London, Asil, talking to me earlier today. Now, Martin, he's saying there the NTC, he believes, is navigated, as the expression he used, by foreign countries, and that the rebels are really NATO's ground troops. I mean, that's not the sort of view we've been hearing, is it?
No, it's not. And I don't suppose his view is necessarily the view of all of the Libyans either. As I've said many times during this crisis, it's not for us to decide what the Libyans should think.
I mean, he's probably a bit biased because the Tripoli government were paying for him to come to study in London.
You know, we had our student protests in Britain last year about paying fees. I mean, Libyan students who do well are funded to the full limit of what they're capable of doing, even if they're studying in foreign universities. And that does lead to a degree of loyalty to the regime. I don't feel that he was supporting Gaddafi because he's being bullied. He's supporting Gaddafi because some people in Libya do support Gaddafi.
Well, many people, he was saying, in fact.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the understanding I have is that there is actually, Gaddafi is becoming a kind of Churchill figure in Libya, even for people who are critical of him, because at the end of the day, Libya is for the Libyans. And I think what I would like to see, he said the National Transitional Council should opt out. What we need is what the South Africans have said, it's what the Chinese have said, what the Russians have said. We need a ceasefire and a negotiation. And that's what we push for. When I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, we used to say to the Croats, the Serbs, the Muslims, stop shooting, let's talk it out. And I think that is the way forward. It's got to be the way forward, surely.
Do you want to have the last word on Libya, Leslie?
Well, Emily, I agree with Martin on that one, because we can't afford to go on as we are doing.
Okay, next story. BBC journalists strike for the second time over World Service job cuts. And this is on Monday. The strike followed an earlier 24-hour walkout on 15th of July in protest at compulsory redundancies at the BBC World Service and BBC Monitoring, where the corporation is looking to axe 387 posts because of cuts in government funding. A 20-strong picket line at Bush House in London hailed a giant sheet with the words BBC kills World Service. Martin Plout, the Africa editor at the World Service, said, I'm furious to be on strike today. I'm really not happy at all. In all my time at the BBC, he joined in 1984, I've never seen the BBC in this state. So, ongoing strikes, Leslie. It's not looking good, is it? And there are also, of course, other problems in the public sector. But what are your thoughts about the BBC journalists walking out on Monday?
I don't like to see anybody going out on strike, but that's a personal view. And I think the World Service is probably one of our stars. I take a different view on some of the UK BBC programmes, because I think they're a bit too left-wing biased, and there are a lot of problems. They're paying an awful lot of money to a few big stars who don't deserve that money, but the World Service is ace.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I think the World Service, as Leslie says, I mean, if you want to influence things in Libya, you need to have a credible voice through which you can influence things. And if you put sticky tape over your mouth, then nobody will hear you, will they?
One of the problems here is that the BBC staff have said there are plenty of people, or actually members of staff, who are happy to be made redundant voluntarily. But what the BBC are doing is they're actually intervening and saying we want specific members of staff sacked. Now, that, of course, gives the management the ability to be quite political about the way they stand. sack, where they sack people and who they sack, possibly for their politics. So I think that's one of the reasons why this strike is taking place. It's potential anyway that certain people could actually be being bullied for their political views.
Well, I think one of the problems we've got is that we have a macho management style in Britain, full stop. And the BBC has copied the macho management style that we've seen in other parts of industry. Frankly, as we were talking about in Libya, jaw is better than war most of the time. And, you know, if you look to places like Norway, for example, which have been run by the Labour Party since 1945, they don't have many big strikes in Norway because they don't need to. They sit around a table and they sort it out.
Leslie, final word on this whole business of the wider possibility of strikes. Don't you think that as the cuts kick in, Britain is going to go back to a sort of winter of discontent like we had in the 1979, 1980?
I think the government will take action if they try to do that.
What sort of action? What, taking away union rights? I mean, that's not correct, is it? That's not the right thing to do.
Well, I'm not quite sure how they're going to do it, but I don't think they'll allow a winter of discontent in the same way as we had in 1979.
Martin?
I think that it's very difficult to organise general strikes, and a lot of left-wing people who talk about that don't know what they're talking about. But on the other hand, if the banks collapse, there is going to be a revolt in Britain and elsewhere.
Well, that's coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Frome Valley, Leslie Alexander. After the news, the NHS is not for sale.
Your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a British teenager has been mauled to death by a polar bear in Norway. 17-year-old Horatio Chappell was taking part in an expedition which was camping out on a glacier on the remote island of Svalbard. Four other members of the group were seriously injured in the attack. The bear was later shot dead. Arctic explorer Tom Avery says the melting ice sheets in the Arctic forces the animals to travel further for food.
Polar bears are getting hungry.